everybody. Welcome to episode 673 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This episode, we're going to be continuing our look at Heroes in Crisis. I'm going to break down issue 3, and I'm also going to talk about Aquaman number 43, which is Kelly Sue DeConnick's first issue on the book. And it's a really good start, actually. It's very intriguing what Kelly Sue is doing. So let me go ahead and start with Heroes in Crisis number 3. It's written by Tom King. We have Clay Mann handling the art on page 1 and page 20. Pages 2 through 19 are by Lee Weeks. We have Tameyu More on colors and Clayton Cowell on letters. The regular cover is by Clay Mann and Tameyu More, and then we have the variant cover by Ryan Sook. And as has been the theme of the variant covers throughout, it's pretty important moments in the history of some of the most important characters in the DC universe. So we saw the variant cover of issue 1 had the death of Superman. Issue 2 had Bane breaking Batman's back. And this issue 3, we see Wonder Woman standing over the body of Maxwell Lord after she had snapped his neck. So as all the issues have so far, it starts off with a confession. So a 9-panel grid with a hero kind of looking at the camera and talking. But this time it's 3 different heroes, and they introduce themselves in the first panel. So across the top from left to right, we have Lagoon Boy, The Flash, and Booster Gold, with each of them introducing themselves and Flash introducing himself as Wally West, The Flash. I guess just in case somebody might think it's Barry Allen. I mean, he has the silver and red costume. His hair is exposed, so clearly Wally West, not Barry Allen. In the second panel for each, they kind of give their nicknames, which I'm not really that familiar with Lagoon Boy. I don't know if he ever had one, but he does say it's new. He says, Master of the Lagoon. It's new. Wally, of course, the fastest man alive, and Booster, the greatest hero you've never heard of. And then they go on to tell us kind of how long they've been at Sanctuary, with Lagoon Boy saying, you know, I've been at Sanctuary for 3 months and some more days, a long time. I guess I think it's a record. Wally's telling us he's been there 2.5 weeks, and Booster says, this is my first day, first time, first visit. You're welcome. So as we turn to the next page, we see Lagoon Boy standing in a forest getting zapped by a laser that appears to go through his midsection. So I'm not sure what that's all about yet, but we're going to learn more in just a second. Wally, we see on the following page, is laying on his bed, holding one of the Sanctuary masks, but not wearing it, speaking to his son, apparently saying, come on, Jay, don't be scared. It's just a mask. It's still me. It's still just Daddy, as he's putting the mask over his face. But it's not clear who he's talking to. Because remember, in this current reality of the DC Universe, he never got married to Linda Park, and Jay and Iris, his children, don't exist. On the following page, we see the automatons that we saw destroyed in the first issue are still functioning. So, you know, obviously this is a flashback. No one's dead yet. And they're greeting somebody new who's just showed up at Sanctuary. They're saying, welcome, pleasure to have you. Our home is your home. And when we pan back in the next panel, we see that it's Booster. Booster's just arrived. And he's really putting on a brave face, really trying to seem to be positive, seem to be happy to be there. He's saying, thanks, it's great to be here. Going to be a good time. This is awesome. And they tell him, okay, come inside. You know, things are prepared. So then the scene shifts to Lagoon Boy, and we see that he's actually not hurt, but he does seem maybe a little stiff, maybe a little sore, and he's getting up. There's no blood. There's no hole in his midsection, and he's struggling to get to his feet, and he says, again. And as he's walks back into place, he shouts it again, and we see his zap, and he gets knocked back by that blue laser once again. So again, it's really strange. Not sure what's going on with Lagoon Boy at this point. Meanwhile, we see Wally, and he's in what I guess could most easily be described as some sort of holodeck, which I believe they're called chambers, which we'll get to that in a little bit. But he's standing in this this holodeck type room, and the computer voice is saying, "Yes, Wally," and he says, "The backyard." "Why here, Wally?" Linda and his wife appears, and the computer's asking him, "What is it about Linda?" And she's running up to him saying, "You're home." And then Wally requests Jay and Iris to be there. The computer again asking, "Please, Wally." The kids are running up to give him a hug, saying, "Daddy, Daddy." And the computer continuing to ask, "Why Jay? Why Iris? Like, why are you asking for things? Why do you need them? Like, why these things?" Meanwhile, Booster's getting introduced to Sanctuary. He's getting sort of the tour, getting acclimated. And really, he's, in a way, our POV character for this issue in terms of learning what Sanctuary is about. As the older male caretaker has given him a robe, given him the mask, saying, "For reasons of anonymity, a lot of people wear these in the common areas, but some don't. It's up to you." Again, Booster putting on the brave face, saying, "Oh, that's outstanding." And the guy goes on to explain, "You don't have to go to the common areas. They can bring meals to your room. It's whatever you want. And we'll escort you to the chambers," which is in bold, which is how we find out what those sort of holodeck type rooms are. And he says, "We'll make sure no one sees you if you don't want." And again, Booster, fantastic. So he really, you know, he's acting like he's happy to be there. Like, this is a great place to be, right? Like, it's a vacation. And the older gentleman shows him to his room, saying, "If you need anything, just say it. And when you're ready for your chamber sessions, just let us know." So Booster's response to that is, "Swell." And then after the guy leaves, he goes and sits on his bed, and he's holding his head in his hand. So clearly, if he was this happy and this excited to be here, he wouldn't be sitting on the edge of his bed as soon as he has a moment of privacy in this dejected pose. So it's really great art by Lee Weeks, actually, to kind of give us some context into how Booster is really feeling, as opposed to sort of the brave face. And Booster's not one to really kind of let his negative emotions show, even with Skeets, even to himself. He sort of puts on a brave face. I think he's one of those heroes that has a tendency for self-deception. It's kind of built into his, who he is, his DNA as a character from, you know, the very first, when he threw football games and ruined his potential lucrative career, sports career and endorsement career. And then when he decided to steal from the museum and travel back in time and become a hero, I mean, there's something inherently unheroic about that, about stealing a bunch of equipment and heading back in time, where you have the advantage of foresight and knowledge. And, you know, he has no superpowers on his own, but he has shown himself to be a hero. I think he's definitely redeemed himself over the last, you know, 30 years. I think it was 85 or 86 when he debuted. I think right around there. Maybe 87 at the latest. So he's been around for, you know, 30 years, and he's definitely, as I said, redeems himself in that time. So he's never stopped putting on the brave face, being the sort of smiling hero, and, you know, just like his nickname, the greatest hero you've never heard of. Even though he has redeemed himself, he's proved himself a hero, there is at his core kind of that used car salesman sort of pitch, right? Like, when he first came to our time, he was endorsing cereal and all kinds of other stuff like that, getting paid. And I remember in that original series, Superman paying him a visit to talk to him about that, because in Superman's eyes, it made him less trustworthy, right? Like, why would anybody, you know, like, if you're there to help people, you should be there to do it because it's the right thing, not because you're getting paid. So anyway, back to the issue. We see Lagoon Boy again laying in this field, in this forest, and he's asking the computer how many lasers, since I got here. And the computer responds, 337. So he's been shot by that laser 337 times. And even Lagoon Boy says, well, that's a lot. And the computer says, yes. And Lagoon Boy says, well, it seems like a lot. And again, the computer, yeah, it's a lot, Lagoon Boy. And then we start to get a little bit of context. And Lagoon Boy says that when he's not here, when he's not there at Sanctuary, it's all he sees. All he sees is that laser. like all the time. And even when he's back with the Titans and he's training and everything's good, then Power Boy is stabbed, little Barda screams, and the laser just goes in him. Like he sees it so many times every day when he wakes up, when he goes to sleep, over and over and over, he sees it. So I don't know if he's reliving a nightmare or if this is something that actually happened. But he goes on to say that for the computer, it's been 337 times. The computer can count. The computer can keep track of it. But for Lagoon Boy himself, it just seems like it's always happening over and over and over. Whether he's awake, whether he's asleep, over and over and over, he's seen himself get killed by this laser. Again, I don't know if it's something that actually happened or if it's some kind of nightmare or just it's not clear. But this is why he's subjecting himself to this. He's trying to get a handle on it. He's trying to understand it. On the next page, we see Mr. Freeze, which is a really strange jump, right? Like you finish with Lagoon Boy. And as I said, that previous page, he's laying on the ground in the forest on the grass. And each panel, as we scroll down the page or look down the page, we're getting closer and closer to his face, and we zoom all the way in on one of his eyes, and it's very intimate as he's giving us more and more of the details of why he's going through what he's going through, why he's torturing himself with this laser. And so it's an interesting setup because you're zooming in and it feels very personal, and then you turn the page and you're like fully invested, you've focused in on a Lagoon Boy, and you turn the page and it's Captain Cold holding his cold gun, like pointing it right at you, saying freeze. And it's just like, whoa, that's a big, big transition. And we see it's actually Wally with Jay and Iris in their costumes, because they used to fight alongside their father. And he's asking them if they're ready. And they're saying, yeah, we're ready. We love you, Daddy. And the computer is asking Wally if this is enough. And Wally ignores the computer, rather, ignores it, and instead answers his kids by saying, I love you too. And the computer, again, trying to get answers out of Wally, saying, is this what you want? Like, is this, you miss your family, you want your family back. It's been Wally's kind of overriding emotion, his desire, why he wants to fix whatever's wrong with the DC Universe currently, because again, in this reality, he never married Linda Park and he never had these kids, and he's consumed with their loss. And so is this what he wants, to live in Sanctuary, to live in one of these chambers so that he can feel like he has his family back? Is that really what he wants? Or is it something more? Is the computer, trying to help Wally kind of process his loss? Meanwhile, on the next page, we see Booster, and I guess it's in his room. He's in his room, or maybe not. Maybe it's hard to tell by the background. He might be in one of the chambers, but it must be a chamber because he's saying to the computer, so this chamber becomes what I need it to become. And the computer responds, yes. And he's like, oh, cool. Again, putting on the brave face. And we get some more explanation of the way Sanctuary works here. Again, Booster Gold, kind of our POV character. So we established that it's Kryptonian crystal technology and it's built by Batman. So that's what the Trinity made this Sanctuary happen. And that was Batman's contribution, right? He built it. Like, he was hands-on, and it comes from Superman's Kryptonian technology with Wonder Woman's compassion. So again, we've seen this before in the series, I think in issue one, where we talked about the fact that it was, Batman's will, Superman's optimism or hope, and Wonder Woman's compassion. So it's of all three, and it's important. And it's, again, Tom King just kind of stressing the importance of the Trinity in the DC universe, and certainly as they relate to other heroes. So the computer asks where Booster would like to go, actually refers to him by Michael, Michael Carter is his true identity. And he's like, I don't know, where should I go? And the computer says, well, whatever comes to mind. And so he lists off different places I can go, whatever. And the computer says, yeah, whatever. And Booster is trying to understand. He's like, and that helps? And I love the response by the computer. The computer says, well, what do you mean by help? And Booster spells it out for him. I mean help, H-E-L-P. Isn't that what you do here? And again, the computer says, go where you want to go and be there. And Booster's like, what? Be there? What is that? What do you mean, be there? And the computer says, yes, just be there. And so Booster is still trying to understand, okay, so I go there and I'm there and that's it? The computer says, well, mostly. But the thing is, while you're there, try to know why you're there. So it's just like we saw with Wally, right? When Wally called for his backyard, the computer wanted to know why. And then Wally called for Linda, and the computer again, why Linda? Then he's calling for Jay and Iris. Why Jay and Iris? Why do you need them? And then, you know, on the previous page where Wally is getting ready to fight Captain Cold with his two kids, and the computer saying, is this what you want? Again, why? You need to understand why. And so when the computer tells Booster, try to know why you're there, he says, I knew it, the why, now I get it. And the computer's like, oh, you do? That, you know, like, yeah, that's good. And Booster says, no, that's the catch. It is? That's the trap. And the computer says, no, Michael, that's the help. The help is the why. Understanding yourself, that's the why. But for Booster, I could see why he would think of that as a trap. Because again, he's always been a hero, I think, who's been very capable of self-deception. And so to examine the why are you doing something, is to have self-realization. It's so for someone like Booster, it would definitely feel like a trap or a catch, right? Like, I don't know. I don't want to think about it too much. I don't want to self-reflect or look inward too much because I might not like what I find. Better to just put on a brave face and keep moving forward. But the other thing that's really interesting about this page with Booster is that it looks like there are fingerprints all over the page, like on top of Booster, like somebody, you know, got fingerprint ink on their fingers and basically kind of stuck it on the page here and there, especially around the borders. So I'm not sure what that means, like why that's there. I mean, it's so obvious. I know artists from time to time would use their fingers to smudge ink and to give effects or whatever, but this is not that. This is so blatantly like fingerprints, like crime scene fingerprints. So it's very, very interesting. And I wonder if it'll come back to play later, or if it'll just end up being it was just a cool effect that Lee Weeks wanted to use. Just not sure. So back to Lagoon Boy and the forest, and he's talking about it feels better to have the laser on the outside than on the inside, but who knows, maybe it'll feel better. And now we start to get to the real reason he's doing this. As he gets zapped by the laser again, he's saying, maybe one of these days one of the blasts won't hurt and he won't be scared. And when it comes, because he believes this dream that he's had about this laser, this vision that he's had that he sees over and over, he believes it's going to come to pass. And if he can get used to it here in Sanctuary, then maybe when it happens, it won't hurt and he won't be scared. He'll be able to handle it. And it'll hit him. And whether the laser's real or not, one day he'll just know that he's real. And the laser's not, and that's okay. And then maybe he says, you know, maybe I'll just laugh or something. And we get another zap as he gets hit again. So it's almost like he's trying to inoculate himself against his fear. Like he totally believes the laser's coming. He's not even trying to keep it from happening, but he's just trying to face his fear, right? Like they say, oh, if you're afraid of heights, go to the top of a tall building and look down. If you're afraid of swimming, just, you know, jump in the water. Like face your fears head on so that you can see they're not that bad. You can put yourself in that situation, you survive it, and you try to tell yourself, so it, you know, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. It didn't kill me. I'm stronger for having gone through it. And it seems like that's what Lagoon Boy's doing, except 337 times. I don't know, man. Maybe give it up, because it certainly doesn't seem to be working. So, yeah, very, very interesting what Lagoon Boy is doing here. Meanwhile, on the next page, we see Barry tucking Iris in, and she's asking him how he got his powers, and he explains it to her, and it's so funny. She's like, that's silly, Daddy. That doesn't make any sense, which I don't know if it's Tom King being metatextual. I mean, there's been a lot of talk over the years of how Wally's origin is so, like, impossible, basically. I mean, not that Barry's wouldn't be, right? Like, lightning douses you with chemicals and you get some super speed powers. Yeah, that makes no sense at all. But then for the exact same thing to happen to his nephew years later, I mean, it's really, really far-fetched, even for comics. Which is why I think it was in the Secret Wars annual number one, the Secret Wars series, not Secret Wars, Secret Origins. The Secret Origins annual number one from like 1987 was a Flash-focused issue. And it basically told the story of Wally's origin as that lightning bolt was actually Barry. So what happened was when Barry sacrificed himself during Crisis on Infinite Earths, he didn't actually die, but he entered, I guess in the context of today, you would say he entered the Speed Force. But the Speed Force didn't exist. Mark Waid hadn't thought it up yet. And obviously it's been retconned in so that when Barry did sacrifice himself during Crisis on Infinite Earths, that is where he went. He went into the Speed Force. That's been changed. But at the time, the Secret Origins Annual 1 was written, it didn't exist, but it was just postulated that Barry ran so fast that he turned himself into a bolt of lightning, traveled back in time, and was the lightning bolt that gave Wally his power. So it was kind of like this self-fulfilling circular sort of existence for Barry. And I just remember reading that version of the origin of Wally West as Kid Flash and thinking that was really cool, because it explained it a little better. It kind of explained away the coincidence. It wasn't just a coincidence. It was Barry knowing that, you know, a future Barry that had the foreknowledge of what an incredible hero Wally West would become, and making sure that he became that hero by literally becoming the lightning bolt that gave Wally his power. So it's probably been changed by now. I honestly don't know what Wally's current origin is, if it's been changed here or there over the years. So that's the one that I remember. That's the one that I stick to, because again, it explains away the coincidence of it very well. But here it's Iris saying, well, that doesn't make any sense at all, and Wally agreeing, saying, no, honey, it doesn't make any sense. So we turn the next page. We see that Booster is indeed in one of the chambers, but he hasn't chosen to go anywhere. But what he has chosen to do is bring a copy of himself there. And his copy is giving him a hard time, saying, this, you could have wished for anything. We could have been on a beach with a Tamarian princess, but you wish for this. And the actual Barry is, you know, like arguing with himself, I guess, saying the robot thing said it didn't matter. You're just part of the computer thing. You're not supposed to be judging me. And the copy of him, the holographic version, is saying, who's judging you? And Booster's saying, you are right now, you. So very interesting. It's almost like, again, with the idea that Booster, more so than any hero, really practices self-deception, the way he can kind of confront himself is by sort of stepping outside himself. And the way he has done, the way he's chosen to do that is by creating a copy. And so I think it's much more realistic to think that this copy would be saying things that Booster himself thinks about himself. Except you wonder, so how would the Sanctuary, how would the Kryptonian crystal technology know that? But the clue we get right away, because we know the vanity of Booster Gold, is that the copy says, hey, what's going on with your forehead there? Are you losing your hair? And then we turn the page and we're back to Lagoon Boy in the forest. And the laser is just about to hit him. And he asks for the computer to stop. And he says, I'm tired. I'll come back tomorrow. Is that okay? And he turns around and walks away from the laser as it's suspended in midair. And the computer is saying, of course, come back, you know, whenever. But as Lagoon Boy turns to walk away, all of a sudden we hear sort of an announcement coming over the, I guess, over the speakers of Sanctuary saying, emergency, emergency, please proceed to the nearest exit. We see Wally running through the halls of Sanctuary hearing the same thing, saying no. And I imagine he's saying no because he doesn't want to be interrupted. He doesn't want to be leaving the chamber because he feels that's where his real life is, right? That's the life he knew, his beloved wife, his children that he misses right now. And if he's got to come back to the real world and he's not living in a chamber, then he's not living his what he believes to be his true life. But again, the announcements proceed saying, emergency, emergency, go to the nearest exit. Emergency, emergency, please proceed to the nearest exit. Back with the two boosters, we see that the original booster gives a right cross to the sort of the holographic one, and he says, wow, okay, I feel better. I think I like therapy. And he's hearing the same announcement, emergency, emergency, please proceed to the nearest exit. And meanwhile, the faux booster, you know, hears him say, I think I like therapy. And he kicks him in the midriff saying, yeah, you like this? And as he's laying there on the floor, he says to himself, I hate you. And his fake self, the faux booster, says, oh, you're as insightful as you are balding. And the real booster says, I should have gone to Honolulu with the Tamarian princess. And the fake one says, you know, I tried to tell you. So again, it really seems like this booster is saying the things that Booster thinks about himself, but maybe can't verbalize. So I think it actually was a good idea for him to try to do this. Unfortunately, interrupted by this emergency message. Proceed to the nearest exit, because this might have been a way for Booster to pull himself out of that self deception, the lies that he tells himself when he's confronted, and you know, maybe he can't tell himself in his own head, but if his self is sitting there in front of him, he can work up the courage to tell himself. So finally, after about the third time, the boosters finally sort of pay attention to the announcement that's being made, emergency, emergency, please proceed to the nearest exit. And the real booster says, should we do something about that? And the faux booster responds, well, you're the superhero, you tell me. So meanwhile, Lagoon Boy has gone outside. He has proceeded to the nearest exit. And as he's looking down on Kid Devil and Gunfire, which are, I believe it's Hotspot is the third, and he's saying, what's going on? They're all, and then we see him stabbed through the midriff, very similar to how that laser did. It doesn't necessarily look like a laser. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but it does hit him in the same spot. And he's finally able to laugh. He's like, but what? Huh? And he just starts laughing, probably at the irony or the absurdity of it all. So next, we see that Arsenal has been killed as well, because when Barry reaches the porch, he's holding Roy in his hand, saying, Roy, why? Why did it? He doesn't finish, but I'm saying, what? Probably, why did it happen? And he's talking about his kids. He's saying, I didn't want to be alone, right? I mean, he was so used to having that family, having those people who were closer to him than anyone has ever been. And yes, he's back. He's out of the Speed Force. Geoff Johns returned him in that DC Universe Rebirth one shot. But he's, in terms of the closeness that he had with his kids and with his wife, it's not there. And he does feel more alone than he has in a long time. And so you could take it two ways, and I'm not exactly sure which way Tom means it. Like, is Wally feeling guilty that he didn't know something was going on in Sanctuary, that he wasn't able to stop whatever or whoever it was that killed Roy because he was spending time in a fantasy, basically, in one of the chambers because he wanted his kids, he wanted his wife, he didn't want to be alone? Or is he in some way responsible, like the rumors we've heard, for, you know, on a greater level, for what's gone wrong, and he realizes he's at fault, and so he's apologizing to Roy for what's happened, for the fact that Roy paid a price because Wally has done something, and we don't know what it would be, we don't know what it could be yet, but, you know, these speedsters, they can mess with time, they can vibrate between dimensions, so is he apologizing because he was doing something and trying to get his kids back that caused this problem at Sanctuary? Or is he, and so he's feeling guilty for that reason? Or is he feeling guilty that he didn't come out of the chamber soon enough because he didn't want to be alone and you know, he didn't get a chance to save Roy? Could be one of either of those, I think, or he could mean something else completely different. But as he's there holding Roy, all of a sudden we get a big bang and we see he's been hit on the back of the head with a hammer by Harley. And as she looks up, she sees Booster standing there. And she goes, "Oh, I didn't know you were there." And Booster says, "Well, actually, it's my first day." Harley, I think, just killed Wally. Like, there's blood dripping off the back of her hammer. She whacked him in the back of the head and, you know, he immediately slumped over. And Booster's not really, I don't know, it's almost like he's in a state of shock. And maybe he is because, you know, he mentions to Harley it's his first day and Harley's like, "Oh, neat. How's it going so far?" And Booster's response is, "Well, everyone's dead. So everybody was dead, or everybody is dead, except for Wally, Booster, and Harley. Except Wally could be dead now, too." And so, yeah, not sure. Just not sure. It's definitely a mystery. We don't know yet what exactly Tom King's end goal is yet. But we do get one more 9-panel grid on the last page, another of the confessionals. And it's 9 different heroes. They're introducing themselves and they're talking about how long they've been there. And again, these are all mostly second tier characters. You know, Wally and Arsenal, Booster and Harley are really the big characters. I guess Poison Ivy as well, maybe just a step below those. But a lot of these guys, like Commander Steel, I thought he was dead. I thought he'd been dead a long time ago because I know he was in the Blackest Night storyline as a zombie, but apparently he's back to life now. I don't know, maybe it's rebirth, not sure, but he gives his name, you know, Commander Steel, the Indestructible Man. I've been here 3 weeks. Next we have Gunfire, who I'm very unfamiliar with. I mean, I know his name and I know he exists, but I don't know that I've ever read a comic that he's in. And he says, "I am the weapon." That's his logo, I guess you'd say, or his catchphrase. And he says, "I've done 6 days." Next, we have the Tattooed Man, the Living Ink, and he says, "I've been here like 2 months." Next guy, definitely haven't heard of, Narc, G-N-A-R-R-K, and he says, "Narc, the Last Cro-Magnon, 12 days. Next is Red Devil, who we saw dead outside right before Lagoon Boy got it. He says, "The Kid Devil, all grown up, it's been a month or more." Next, we have Protector, who looks very, very young, looks like a teen hero, in a very Superman-esque type costume, but with a full face mask. And he says, "Protector, just say no. This is my 4th week. Then we get a name we're familiar with, Poison Ivy. And she says, you know, Poison Ivy. And her, I love her, kind of her call sign or her logo, catchphrase, whatever. It's just Pam, 1 week, 9 days. Then another hero I'm not familiar with at all. Don't think I've ever heard of this person at all. She says her name is Solstice, the Light, and she's been there 11 weeks. And then we get Nemesis, who doesn't have a call. He says, "Nemesis, just that. I've got 1 week behind me." and then we get the to be continued. So I don't know if this is just kind of a morbid roll call, so to speak, so that we know who else has been killed. Because like Booster said, everybody's dead. So all these heroes were there and are now dead. And what does that mean? And who's behind it and why? Those are all questions that we still have to answer. So I like this story. I like the non-linear narrative that Tom King's using. I like the fact that we're getting a glimpse of before. Because again, with that first issue, if you remember, we started kind of in the middle of the story. Everybody was dead. You know, Booster and Harley had escaped. They got in a big fight. The Trinity showed up at Sanctuary and everybody was gone. And so it's nice to... And I think I talked about this when I covered the first issue, how I had said I thought we would get a little bit of story of kind of how Sanctuary worked, and we would sort of see what's going on there, and then the stuff would kind of hit the fan. But Tom decided to start in the middle, so to speak, and I like that we have gotten this kind of flashback, and not only does it give us an idea of the way Sanctuary works, it's also a real eye-opener in terms of kind of the state of mind that Booster and Wally were in or have been in at Sanctuary. Harley to a lesser extent, because we haven't really seen much of her, and technically she's not even supposed to be there, right? Like, she didn't get invited. And the only reason she even knew about it is because she followed Poison Ivy. So if we get more Harley, I'd be surprised. Because again, I don't think she has a room. I don't think she's necessarily in the chambers. But she just went there to try to protect Ivy, because she has the feelings for Ivy and doesn't like to be separated from her. So if we get some idea of what Harley's up to, it may come later rather than sooner. And it's especially interesting because she's the one that knocked Wally on the head and apparently killed him, and sure looked like she'd killed him. She hit him really hard. But you know, later in issue one and issue two of the series, we see, and you know, obviously issue one and two are before issue three, but later in terms of linear time, she tells anybody who will listen that Booster did it. She saw Booster kill all these guys. Well, she may have seen Booster kill everybody else, but it doesn't seem like it based on what we saw in this issue. And Booster certainly didn't kill Wally. Harley doesn't have anybody to blame for Wally's death but herself. So it's a great issue. It really, like I said, gives us a lot more insight into Sanctuary and how it works. And there's great Lee Weeks art. It's really incredible. And I'm sure part of it had to do with just how detailed Clay Mann's art is, and that's probably why he needed to have somebody fill in for issue three so he could get caught up again. He basically gets a few extra weeks to draw the following issue, and in hopes of getting back on track. And so, you know, I love Clay Mann art, and I wish Clay could have done every issue, but I totally understand it. And if you're going to get somebody to fill in, I think it's great that you get Lee Weeks, whose art works works on the same level as Clay Mann's. I don't think it has quite the detail that Clay Mann's art has, but their sensibilities in terms of the way they frame panels, when they zoom in on faces, the layouts within the panels, all that is actually very similar. So I'm wondering if Clay gave any input to Lee on, this is what I was thinking for this page, this is what I was thinking for this page. And then obviously Clay handles the first page and the last page where we get the confessional. So there is some consistency from issue to issue based on that as well. So yeah, really, really great issue. Can't wait for more. And I think issue 5 is the last Heroes in Crisis issue that came out as I record this. I think it just came out within the last few days as I record this. So We still have issue 4 and 5 to cover, and I'll be talking about those on upcoming Friday spotlights. But I think 4 issues, because I think it's 9 or 10 issues overall, so 4 or 5 more issues, and I'm really digging it. It's quite the mystery, but it's quite compelling, and you know, it's a quality story, as I've come to expect from Tom King. So if you haven't tried it, I would recommend it. It's definitely worth it. All right, next up, I'm going to talk about Aquaman number 43 by Kelly Sue DeConnick. We have art by Robson Roca. I think it's Roca. Somebody told me on Twitter, I think, that I was pronouncing it wrong, but I can't remember if I was saying Rocha or Roca. So whoever that was, remind me again. I think it's Robson Roca. I think it's a hard CH because it's Portuguese. I think that's what they said. But anyways, apologies if I'm saying it wrong. I need to get the correct pronunciation of that down. We have inks by Daniel Enriquez, colors by Sonny Goh, and letters by Clayton Cowles. Also, there's the regular cover by Roca, Enriquez, and Goh, and then there's a Nicola Scott and Annette Kwok variant cover, which is really awesome, sort of Aquaman movie themed. It even has a little logo in the corner that says Aquaman only in theaters December 21st, and it's clearly Jason Momoa and Amber Heard, and it's Nicola Scott. I mean, beautiful cover. And the other thing that I want to say before I dive into the issue is thank you, DC, for not starting this over with a number one. Just because we have a new writer and a new direction doesn't mean we need a new number one. I'm really glad, and especially considering the Aquaman movie, that they could have easily gone to a number one, a new jumping on point for lovers of the movie, and they didn't do it, and I'm really happy. So the story starts off, it's pouring rain, we're on a coastline somewhere, and not sure who's narrating, but they're talking about in the beginning how there was just the ocean, and the ocean was the source and the rule, and the land was sort of the exception, which certainly is an apt description of our planet, the planet Earth. It's, you know, the vast majority of it is covered by water more every day as the polar ice caps melt. And so land is sort of the exception. And this narrator, whoever it is, goes on to talk about the vanity of man and how we sort of forgot where we came from, and we drew lines in the dirt to try to divide us ourselves and into nations and defend, and became obsessed with all that stuff, and forgot that man only existed by the mercy of the ocean, because the ocean could rise up and destroy it at any time. And it goes on to say that we turned our backs on the ocean, and she returned the favor. Like, one day she just forgot about us and said whatever, left us to our own devices. And one day she's going to tire of the insolence and reclaim us all. And basically, the water will cover all. But not today, the voice says. And all during this narrative, as I said, we're on a coastline. We see a woman walking in the rain and the wind, and she's leaving a sacrifice of roses and what looks to be a dead rabbit for someone. She leaves it on the shore next to the water, with rocks sort of piled up around the rabbit to sort of hold it in place. And we see that Aquaman is standing near a home, some kind of a stone dwelling, and he's watching this woman walk back from having left her sacrifice. And he opens the door, Aquaman opens the door to the home, saying she's going to get herself killed, speaking to the two inhabitants inside. And they're like, oh, Callie? And is what the woman says, whose name is Wee. And the man, Locke, says, yeah, well, who else would be fool enough to wander around in this weather? And she says, who indeed, Locke? Maybe the fool who nailed our shutters closed so you wouldn't smash your thumb. And she's referring to Arthur, to Aquaman, saying, I only did it because you promised me soup, Wee. And Locke's complaining that it's potato soup and that there's no fish, there's no protein. And Wee scolds him, saying, hey, catch some fish. You want stew? Catch some fish, and I'd be happy to do it. And then we get some lightning close by with a giant crack, and they all look up startled by the lightning, with Locke talking about how angry the sea is, and Arthur kind of poo-pooing that idea, which is interesting considering who he is, saying that water can't be angry, Locke, it's just a storm. And we mumble something about things getting worse, and it's deliberate, and Nama, and Locke kind of scolds her into silence. And then Aquaman asks if he can stay there for the night. He says, you know, I'm not anxious to catch my death, and I might come in handy if the wind takes the roof. And so they're thankful that that Aquaman will stay. And the next day, the storm is broken. We see a brilliant sunrise with the sun rising up over the water. We see Callie in her red dress down near the shore. And she's walking up, I think, where she left that sacrifice. And Arthur appears by her, and she says, "Speak your mind, Aricio, or walk away. I won't have you staring at me." And he says, I wasn't staring, and that's not my name. And she says, it could be your name. You don't know. I'm the one who found you. I should get to name you, don't you think?" And on the following page, we see that Aquaman had washed up on shore of this island. He's laying among the rocks and the waves, and we see Callie running up to sort of drag him to safety before the water can wash Aquaman away. And back in present day, Aquaman's telling her that the others call him Andy. And Callie says, "Yeah, that doesn't suit you at all. Sure, it starts with an A. I mean, that's the only thing they had to go on, was the A on Arthur's belt buckle. I figured it's something that starts with an A." And she says, "Yeah, it starts with an A. It means manly, which is fair, but it's she says, it's too light for you. You need a name that requires gravitas." And she says, "Aracio, roll the R." And Aquaman says, "Yeah, Aracio means orange." And Callie says, "Well, it didn't used to, but how did you know that anyway?" And he says, I don't know. I don't know how I know anything." So clearly he's lost his memory. And Callie is saying, "Do you want to know what I think?" And I love this because it's a line that we probably have all said in our lives. Aquaman says, "No, but you're going to tell me anyway." I know I've said that before. People, "Oh, guess what? You know, I have no idea, but you're going to tell me anyway." So Callie says, "You know, I think you don't remember your life before you came to this village, because you had no life before this village. I think you were created fully formed, like Athena was from the head of Zeus. You were a gift from the sea, and you just, you know, you weren't there one second and you were the next. And you've come to save us all." And Aquaman says, the ocean isn't a who, it's a what. And I wasn't born from it. I barely survived it. The ocean doesn't give a crap about you or your rocks or your dead squirrel." And that clearly upsets Callie as she tells him, "It's a rabbit." And he says, "Whatever. I don't care. The storm blew it away. Perfectly good meat. We have old people with barely enough to survive here, and you're throwing good meat away." And meanwhile, Wee shows up saying, Andy, come quick. The nets are full of fish." So Aquaman heads down to the shore. And we see a lot of other inhabitants attempting to pull in these nets that are just overflowing with fish. And they're yelling, "Andy, we need you now." It's clearly they know his strength. And it's an incredible job by Robson Rocha here of showing us the fear in Aquaman's eyes, which, you know, Arthur would never fear the water if he had any idea. But this guy doesn't know that he's Aquaman. He doesn't, you know, all he knows is he almost drowned. And clearly he has a fear of the water. So he says, "I'm here, I'll anchor." And he does get in the water, but he stays pretty close to shore. Meanwhile, we see Locke is way out, you know, neck deep. And he's singing because it won't be potato soup tonight. They'll get actual protein when a giant wave comes and sort of sweeps him away. And Callie is yelling at Andy or Aquaman to save him. And he runs to shore. And again, Callie yelling, "And why don't you go get him? We know it's fear." But Aquaman justifies it by saying, "You know, I can't help him if I've sucked under too." And he grabs a rope and he throws it to Locke. Locke's able to grab it, and he sort of reels Locke in, who's laughing for having survived the ordeal and was dragging a giant net full of fish with him. So once that drama is over, the fishermen have a chance to kind of catch their breath and take stock of what they've caught. And everybody is kind of hit with the smell at the same time. And they realize that the fish, all these fish they've caught, these fish that have filled their nets, every one of them is dead and rotten. And Locke, dejected, standing there next to Wee, saying, "Why is she so angry with us?" Meanwhile, Callie has waded into the water and she's saying, the salt, the brine is too strong. The ocean's actually hurt, Locke. She's hurt. And Wee is saying it's Nama, which again is the second time that we've seen that name. And she goes on to say that for years they've suffered as Nama has raged, and now they've grown old and weak, and their pain has done nothing to temper Nama's bitterness. And they've got to do something, right? Because Nama, they feel, is poisoning the sea, which gives them life, and the ocean's not going to suffer what Nama's doing to it without retaliating. And that's what they believe the dead fish to be. And they believe that Aquaman, Arthur, is the champion that's been chosen by the ocean. And that's why he washed up on their shores of the Unspoken Island. So back in the cabin later that night, it's raining once again and storming. And we and Locke and Arthur or Andy are in there. And they're basically ready to sort of give Andy more information. They've been holding a lot of things back, and they tell him, you think we're superstitious and silly, don't you, Andy? And he says, no. And they're like, yeah, yes, it is. It's our own fault because we've kept things from you. And they start telling Aquaman a story of something that happened a long, long time ago. And they say that, you know, the ocean brought each of them there from far away, like disrespectful children that had sinned against the ocean. She took them from their homes and their people. And Locke says, yeah, we didn't really know at the time, but we thought we were being punished for something. And so we thought that we needed to earn back the ocean's favor. And we all felt like that except for one, a woman named Nama. She felt no shame, and she continually raged against the sea. And she felt that the ocean should never dare to judge her. And so the rest of the inhabitants of the Unspoken Isle sent Nama away. They sent her to live or die on a rocky island miles from their shore. And Locke says, yeah, and we didn't do it to be cruel. We were hoping that she would learn humility and to not think so highly of herself and to be a little more willing to compromise. But not only did they banish her to that island, they kept something. They took something that belonged to her when they banished her to that island. And what they took was her daughter, Callie. And so they believe, we and Locke believe, that the ocean has brought Aquaman to them because they're too weak to make it to the Outer Isles. And even if they do go to the Outer Isles, where Nama is, she'd probably kill them on sight. So they know what they're offering is dangerous, but they need Aquaman to take Callie back to her mother and deliver her to her mother, show her that the people living on the Unspoken Isle want peace. And if they can do that, then maybe the sea will stop being angry with them. What they offer Aquaman in return for this is, if you do this, you may drink of the unspoken water and your memories will return. And they give Arthur a glimpse into this cup holding a liquid. And when he looks in, he sees Mira staring back at him, Mira's face. And Aquaman's like, wait, what have you done to me? Who is she? And he's saying this as he's running out of the house. And as he's leaving, they say, she's someone from your past. And he implores them, stay away from me. And he runs off to try to get away from them. And as he approaches the cliff, he looks down onto the shore and he sees that Callie is down there. And there's a big tidal wave coming in. And he yells for Callie, but apparently she doesn't hear him. And the narrator returns, saying, in the beginning there was the ocean, and that was what the source was, but man was vain, and we turned our backs, and she in turn turned her back on us. But one day she's going to get tired of us ignoring her, tired of man ignoring her, tired of man's insolence, and she's going to reclaim us all. But that day is not today. And as we're getting all this text, we see that Aquaman sort of slides down the cliff face and runs over and grabs Allie right as the wave is about to crash upon her, wraps her up in his arms and says, I've got you, hold tight. But instead of the wave crashing down on top of them, they're untouched by it. And Callie is saying, Horacio? And as they look to either side of them, we see that the sea has parted, kind of like Moses and the Red Sea. And they're just kneeling there on the beach as the water has avoided them, even though it towers over them. And the issue ends with Callie saying, the ocean has a plan for you, Horacio. So like I said, a very good start to Kelly Sue DeConnick's run. Very fast-paced, very mysterious but compelling. An interesting take on Arthur being afraid of the water. An interesting take on him not knowing his name, but still showing a desire to help and be selfless. And wanting to know wanting to know who he is and his reasons for existing, right? And right away, that strong reaction when he is confronted with the vision of Mira shows that, you know, he may not have his memories, but clearly there's some emotion that's triggered when he sees Mira, right? His beloved, because she's so important to him. He's got to feel overwhelmed by it. So it's funny that Kelly Sue at New York Comic Con this last year talked about how she didn't want to talk about the whole or tell stories because, been there, done that so many times, of Aquaman as a character that's of Atlantis and of the surface, but isn't accepted by either because of his other heritage. And, you know, the whole man with a foot in either world doesn't belong to either one, doesn't really know who he is kind of situation. She's like, I think it's time we move past that, you know, that he can't reconcile these two halves of him. It's like, yeah, the story's been told. But in a way, it's similar to the story she's telling. This is more of a fish out of water story. But again, it's about belonging and about knowing who you are, right? Like Aquaman literally has lost his memory and does not know who he is. And so you can draw parallels to the kind of stories Kelly Sue was talking about not wanting to do in terms of Aquaman trying to decide who he wanted to be. What's his identity? Is he the king of Atlantis? Is he a ruler? Is that where his loyalties lie? Is that where he should stay? Is he the husband to Mira? Is he, you know, a father? Is he a Justice Leaguer? Is he a hero? Is he a warrior for the oceans in terms of the ecology of the oceans and the, you know, the pollution and the cleanup and everything that needs to be done there, the endangered species? There's so many different roles that he could wear, so many different hats that he could wear. And I keep going back to the Drowned Earth storyline and how much I enjoyed that version of Aquaman, maybe even more so than the Geoff Johns New 52 version, which I know a lot of people feel like Johns did kind of the definitive run on Aquaman and made him seem, you know, so much less silly and in a much different way than Peter David did. Because, you know, in the 90s when everybody went grim dark or grim and gritty, Aquaman actually had his hand chomped off by piranhas and had a harpoon attached, and it's where he first had the beard and the long hair, and he was just much more, he had much more of an edge to him. And so this is a story sort of in that same vein, but a little bit different. And I feel like this can be really a definitive run, because as much as Kelly Sue said that she didn't want to explore those ideas of a guy from two worlds that belongs to neither, accepted by neither, in a way, Aquaman has never accepted himself as this or that. It almost seems like at times when he's confronted, like he'll go live on the surface for a while, and then when he gets too confronted with the problems of Atlantis, then he'll go to Atlantis, and he's there for a while, but then eventually people start piling on, and he hears all you care about is the surface dwellers, and so then he sort of runs away back to the surface, and it's this continual cycle, right? But who is he? Like, what would he ever stick out and get beyond that point, right? Like, when the going gets tough, just ride it out and see if you can break through it, so you don't have to sort of confront it again at a later time. And so in that way, it's about identity. Like, he needs to decide who he is and stick with it through thick and thin, whether that be King of Atlantis or a superhero on the surface, you know, whatever. He needs to decide his role. And so in that way, it's similar to this, where this is a more literal, he doesn't know who he is and needs to find his way. But it's certainly, as I said, a really interesting start to the story, really compelling, pretty fast-paced. But it still feels like you get a big chunk of story, and the art by Robson Rocha is great. There's a lot of close-ups on eyes and faces, which really helps to convey emotion, obviously. And then there's some panels that are just outright beautiful, like seeing Mira's visage in that cup of the unspoken water is absolutely amazing. There's some great splash pages. The color work is done really, really well. And the entire book has a very different feel than Aquaman had under the Dan Abnett run, which, you know, I was sad to see Dan leave because he did such an incredible job, but he was on the character for quite a while. And Kelly Sue's a great writer too. So, you know, this is her first DC work. So I'm curious to see her kind of spread her wings and see what she does. So again, it's a great start. I think that there's a little bit of the same sort of sensibility or sort of tone in the story as there was in the Aquaman movie. You know, that there wasn't as much of a mystery there as there is here. You know, we understood a lot more about that that story than we do the mysteries of why the ocean is angry and who all these other inhabitants of the island are and who Aquaman is. So this generates a few more questions than the movie probably did, but I think they're close enough that somebody that enjoyed the movie could jump on and read this and probably really, really enjoy it. And then, like I said, the art by Robson Rocha is really, really well done. Some of the best work that I've seen him do. And it's not always easy to draw Aquaman with the flowing hair and the color work as well. Not always easy to color an Aquaman book, especially if a lot of it takes place underwater. There's always the danger of having it look sort of washed out, so to speak. So kudos to the entire creative team. They did a really incredible job. And issue 44 is out already. I've read it, and I'll be talking about that on an upcoming Friday Spotlight as well. So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, if you saw the Aquaman movie and you've never read an Aquaman comic before, 43 is where you want to jump on. I mean, I really would recommend going back even further than that. Like, the Geoff Johns run's great. Everything Dan Abnett did with the character is great. But if you're just looking for a more recent spot to jump on, this is the perfect issue. 43, and like I said, 44 is out as well. so you can get caught up in a relatively quick period of time. So once again, I want to thank everybody for joining. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please be sure to check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.